Welcome to Eat From The Chaff. My name's Finlow Costain. I'm the editor-in-chief of 8.9.com.
And I'm Phil Carson, the UK head of policy for the Nature Friendly Farming Network.
We have a lot of forestry stories across 8.9, but our guests so far have largely been from the farming community. And so today, our special guest is Andy Heald, who's a forestry consultant and a fountain of knowledge, really, in terms of the UK and international forestry scene. So I'm looking forward to that later. But first of all, Phil, we've had a complaint.
Oh dear, tell me more.
And I thought that we ought to deal with this head on. And can I just say, even before we go into this, it's fantastic to have this complaint, really, because it's great to have correspondence. And so if people do have thoughts about things that we're saying, positive or negative, please do get in touch. And this complaint came in from Rob Hindle, who's the executive director from Rural Solutions, which is a large rural land and property consultant. And the kind of basis I work on is that if one person complains and has actually taken the time to write us the email, then the likelihood is that maybe 20 other people are thinking the same thing, but just haven't quite got round to typing their thoughts out. And so what Rob says is, I thought that you and Phil were rather one-eyed, which is a great phrase, on your piece regarding BNG on Wheat from the Chaff this week. You seem to be solely focused on a concern that the BNG process is about enabling the destruction of habitat through the ability to lift and shift plus 10%. And while it's certainly true that many habitats included in the metric should be considered irreplaceable, the BNG process itself isn't there to encourage the destruction of habitats. Whether habitats should be damaged or not is a matter for the whole planning process. The BNG metric and methodology is a means to enable delivery of compensatory gain, not to encourage destruction. Now, I wrote back to Rob, and you know, he and I have been in contact before. Rob has written for the site before, and actually, as part of this correspondence, he did offer to write an article about BNG, which I've welcomed, and I'm looking forward to receiving that and putting it on the site. And I just want to say that we have regularly talked about biodiversity net gain and biodiversity credits as being a good thing. We were responding to a slightly more negative story that appeared on the story last week. But at the same time, I think the criticism from Rob was entirely fair. Perhaps we should have contextualised what we were saying slightly more. And the key point that he's making is that it's the planning system overall that's the key challenge and that we need to update. And BNG is trying to solve a part of that challenge. Any immediate thoughts, Phil?
Yes. I think we probably could have done a lot more to contextualise it and say the principle of biodiversity net gain is a good thing. The fact that government are rolling it out is a good thing. It could lead to lots of very good things. It could provide a very important income source for farm businesses. And it's really just how well it's implemented. And some of those potentially perverse consequences that we did mention have to be acknowledged, and there has to be appropriate safeguards in place. But yeah, I think it's a fair point.
Yeah, absolutely. And I continue to have the concern that BNG may be misused to justify development of irreplaceable habitats by some planning officers, by some councils. But my hope is that that will be a tiny minority, and that the vast majority of the interventions that take place as a result of biodiversity net gain will be good. Now, as if to prove the point that we talk about biodiversity net gain on a fairly regular basis, one of the stories that appeared on the site last week was Highland Estate to generate biodiversity credits with SLR and RePlanet. And I guess the key point here is that biodiversity net gain is an English scheme. Biodiversity credits are being sold around other nations of the UK as well. And I'm just going to go into this story very briefly. This is SLR and RePlanet, who have designed a biodiversity credit project for around 20 kilometres square, which is 20,000 hectares of an unnamed Scottish Highland estate. The aim is to create a land management plan which delivers positive outcomes for biodiversity alongside the delivery of commodities such as timber. And an SLR spokesperson said, "We were asked to design an approach to biodiversity baselining in line with the Wallacea Trust RePlanet methodology to be implemented across the whole estate, including areas such as commercial afforestation where biodiversity losses may be expected." Now, we interviewed a biodiversity project manager from RePlanet called Max Bodmer, who's actually quoted in this article last week. And I mean, he was such an interesting guy to talk to. He had so much knowledge in this area. And if you haven't yet caught up with that particular video news item, please go and look for it on the website. It's also part of the Newsweek podcast. It's really worth having a listen to. What he says about the Wallacea Trust methodology is that it is quite species oriented. So it's a lot about bird species and other sort of species as being indicators of biodiversity. But what they're looking at is peatland management. They're going doing quite a lot of natural regeneration there. And what they're trying to do following the Replanet guidance is to find the metrics, is to use metrics that have been selected, make sure they're relevant to the ecosystem services that are going to be influenced by the proposed changes in land management. And the other thing that I was chatting to Max about was, you know, when you have a large estate, how you balance the commercial aspects, such as commercial forestry, with the habitat, and how you make sure that there is a net biodiversity gain overall. And I thought, as I say, it was a really interesting interview. I felt like I learned a lot.
It will be interesting to see how this work develops over time, and how this informs, I suppose, the development of metrics and methodologies that can apply on a wider basis. It looks like a good opportunity to test things out. It's very good to see an estate really looking at this and looking at it seriously to deliver a whole range of different objectives.
The next story we were going to look at was a call for a radical rethink to reap the benefits of the UK organic market for farmers. Now, this is Soil Association certification, which obviously runs the certification elements of the Soil Association's work in terms of certifying organic farming. This was the launch of their organic market report in 2020. This is the 12th year of growth, of positive growth, they say, despite global political and economic turmoil and the cost of living crisis at home. They're saying that the total market for organics grew 2% in 2023 in the UK, ending the year at 3.2 billion, almost double its value in 2011. But the key point that they're making is that although the market is growing, the amount of farmland that's being used isn't growing, and therefore there's an awful lot of organic imports, basically. And they're making the comparison between the UK, where there's about 3% of land under organic farm management, while in Europe, it's risen now to about 10.4% organic farmland overall. So we're a long way behind. And Scotland, we're not quite comparing like we'd like here. We're saying there's an increase by 6% in the Scottish organic sector. But this is because the Scottish government have made a pledge to double organic by 2026. Why is it, do you think, Phil, that farmers aren't taking advantage of the opportunity that organic and, you know, the value-added elements of organic offer them?
I think there's a mix of different reasons, and I think partly it's as a result of kind of no long-term strategy to support organic farming within the UK. And I think that comparison with the rest of Europe is quite interesting. And you see in certain countries where they've seen massive increases, both in terms of organic sales, but also the area of land under production. And that's as a result of government seeing the value of organic farming in terms of delivering a whole range of different outcomes, reducing reliance on artificial fertilizers, reducing our reliance on artificial or on chemical pesticides as well, but also the public health benefits that can be accrued as well from a greater consumption of organic foods. And I was looking a little bit in this space just before we spoke today, and Denmark is quite often touted as the example to look at. And yeah, that was through focusing on procurement and trying to increase the level of organic food that was being served in public institutions. And as a result of that, they saw an increase in there's other things in there as well, but partly because of this, there was a 70% increase in the organic area of land farmed in Denmark between 2011 and 2019. And there was also a massive increase in terms of organic sales within the food service sector as well. So there were spillover effects as a result of that. And I think that's acknowledging the importance of it.
Do you think part of this is to do with the build-up of the regenerative agriculture movement in the UK, that many more farmers, because regenerative doesn't have this sort of rigid set of rules around it that perhaps organic does, that a lot of farmers who are interested in that sort of agroecological manner of farming are tending to look towards regenerative, which is a movement in the UK, but not so much in the rest of Europe, rather than necessarily turning to organic. Although it's fair to say that an awful lot of regenerative farmers are also organic certified, because that's a route to market that has value.
I was just going to make that point, that quite often those that are going down the regenerative route see the value in kind of adding a premium to what they're producing by taking the step and getting certified as well. So I don't know. I think there's probably an element of that you're less tied to quite rigid prescriptions in some ways, and there's maybe a more of an opportunity to be a bit more fluid in your approach. And I suppose we are starting to see a space where there's standards coming into play which are trying to define regenerative farming, for example, and trying to build in a kind of, suppose, market premium on that front. So I'm not 100% sure how much of an impact that is having, but it's just even interesting looking at the Scottish approach. We're all, I suppose, a joined up set of islands all together, and probably have a similar cultural outlook in terms of regenerative and organic and relationship between those two. And even to see the level of increase in terms of their levels of organic production in that space of time because of alignment with the EU, it's quite interesting. And that would make me think that it is being led by, I suppose, strategy and policy in those spaces. And again, Scotland have obviously brought in their Good Food Nation Act, and there's a whole range of different things that they're looking at in terms of stimulating public procurement, greater focus on health and wellbeing, all those sorts of things.
Thanks so much, Phil. What's number three?
Number three is a subject that we have touched on quite frequently in recent weeks as a result of the weather and a deluge of rain that we've seen over the last few months. So this is an announcement that 40 projects are to benefit from £25 million worth of funding for natural flood management. So essentially, there was an announcement which declared that we are going to invest in nature-based solutions to flooding, and here's the level of funding that we will give to it. So they spoke about a range of different projects that they will deliver. So Severn Rivers Trust, they're looking at a range of NFM measures in a whole different set of catchments. We've got the Ribble Rivers Trust that have been funded to do a lot of different things, looking at slowing the flow, for example, and then also creating ponds, leaky dams, all those sorts of things as well to really kind of intervene and try and reduce flood risk. This comes off the back of a number of applications that were submitted to Environment Agency by community groups, environmental charities, councils, all sorts of things to deliver natural flood management. And on the whole, it's great to see dedicated investment in natural flood management. And we've spoken about the role that it can play in addressing flooding and mitigating against it and helping landscapes adapt to it. But whenever you look at the total level of funding that's directed towards trying to avoid flooding, it's £5.2 billion. And looking at it,
£5.2 billion. So that's £25 million out of £5.2 billion.
Yeah. So you look at it and say, this is good, but I reckon we could do a bit more here.
At the same time, it's worth mentioning again, because this, conversations that we've had with Chris Utley from Stroud District Council, that natural flood management doesn't have to cost a lot. And I mean, this, I think, overall, this means that our approach to flooding necessarily doesn't need to cost £5 billion. But at the same time, what we do need is a really concerted strategy. And this goes back to the previous conversation around organic, that what we need is a national strategy around natural flood management, around soil management, going back to last week's conversation with Niels Corvehield, where he was talking about the way in which if all of the land in the UK was managed regeneratively, we would practically knock the flooding problem on the head. I mean, not entirely, but at least to an extent. And from that perspective, soil is the key, soil and land management. But you know what Chris Utley always says is that really it's about a positive can-do approach, a just-get-on-with-it approach. We don't need lots of big studies. We don't need lots of big infrastructure plans. We just need an awful lot of small interventions across a watershed. And just as a reminder, Chris has delivered, I think, over the course of the last decade, around 900 or so small interventions through the Stroud Valley, earth bunds, trees in streams, just trying to slow the flow of the water. And that has largely sorted out the problem they have in Stroud in terms of flooding.
Completely. And I think one of the things that we have to keep hitting home here whenever we look at natural flood management is in many cases, it's actually more cost effective to introduce these measures than hard flood defences. And I was doing a little bit of reading around this before today, and there's lots of examples where natural flood management has been put into place at lower cost than what the alternative hard flood defences would be. So in the village of Belford in Northumberland, And they introduced natural flood management techniques because hard defences were proving to be ineffective and too costly. So the level of investment that they put into natural flood defences was £200,000. Compared to hard defences, they would have spent £2.5 million. So there's quite a significant level of cost effectiveness if these are done right and done in the right way. And the last thing I would say is just on that point that you made around regenerative land management in the round. And it comes back to that idea of a land use framework, because the regenerative management for reducing flooding, it's going to be a different approach in different landscapes. And we need that kind of overarching framework to determine what we do where.
Fantastic. Thanks so much, Phil. African Development Bank policies are undermining biodiversity. The African Development Bank's Dakar 2 initiative, Feed Africa, Food Sovereignty and Resilience, is the latest and most ambitious addition to the bank's long-standing Feed Africa programme. But the Alliance for Food Sovereignty in Africa, which is AFSA, believes that this strategy is potentially marginalising small-scale farmers, undermining biodiversity and fostering dependency on multinational corporations for seeds and agrochemicals. Well, this can't come as a great big surprise. Yet again, this is essentially an imposition of global policy onto Africa, imposing a Bill Gates-style approach to climate-smart agriculture, technical solutions to reduce CO2, rather than favouring that agroecological approach. And I'm just going to run through the key criticisms and the key recommendations from AFSA, Phil, before I hand over to you. What AFSA are doing, they're calling out the industrialisation of African agriculture. They're particularly criticising the threat to land rights and the environment, the marginalisation of small-scale farmers, threats to biodiversity, and the creation of dependency and control, particularly through patented seed systems. And what they're recommending is that the African Development Bank, Dakar 2, that the whole process is re-evaluated. They want to protect smallholder land rights, promote agroecology, adopt an inclusive approach which values smaller-scale agriculture and smaller-scale farmers, and preserve that agricultural diversity that those sort of gene-patented seeds can threaten.
Yeah, this is quite concerning in the sense that we are seeing the approach that has ultimately delivered or resulted in a whole range of perverse unintended consequences for ourselves in terms of a massive focus on efficiency, a massive focus on technology, a massive focus on simplicity, I think, in many ways. It's just being hoisted upon others, I think, and being seen as a solution, when in many cases we've seen that it results in a whole range of problems. I think there's a real question here of not really potentially listening to what's actually needed and looking at the solutions that might be right in front of your face or might already being employed in many different ways. And then also we need a kind of greater sense of what success actually looks like. I suppose if you're looking at it through a very, very narrow perspective of growth or potentially benefits to those investors that are investing in these places, then this looks like a pragmatic and sensible policy. But if it's actually to deliver benefits for those farmers that are currently farming the land, then I think there is a legitimate case for a rethink in this case.
And as you say, those solutions are already being employed and they are being advocated. They're being advocated pretty vociferously in various different places, but big business has stronger lobbying arms and is more successful at pushing out their perspective, particularly through financial institutions. Let's go to the final story, Phil, before we go to a break.
Yes, and the final story links in with our previous one, and it's titled China and Brazil Can Lead Harmonised Criteria for Green Agriculture. And this is based on a report from the Climate Bonds Initiative, which has delivered a comparison study of Chinese and Brazilian agriculture criteria in an aim to harmonise green standards in the agricultural sector. And this report makes the case that agriculture is big, big business in both countries and is very important to each of their, I suppose, national economies. So we have 25% of Brazil's GDP is as a result of agriculture, and 16% of China's. Both of these countries are big producers, they're big exporters, but they also have really big populations. So China is the largest consumer of agricultural products and simultaneously is also a big producer of grains and fruits. So this study aims to provide the groundwork for both nations to create a shared framework for green agriculture in the future and foster consensus on investment and collaboration in green agriculture between China and Brazil. And in doing so, they seek to boost connectivity across international areas for green farming and direct more international capital into sustainable agricultural sectors. So the report focuses on three key areas, and the first one is to transition to low carbon agriculture, so adopting low carbon techniques, improving efficiency, things like that. The second one is for China and Brazil to harmonize their green agricultural criteria. So looking at common challenges in terms of land degradation, pollution, and climate change, and to share priorities on that front. And then after this, they've put forward seven actionable recommendations. I'll not go through each of these in detail, but they include areas such as prioritizing areas of development, negotiating trade agreements between each other, directing capital flows, and reducing costs.
Should we go to a break? And we're back, and we're joined by Andrew Heald, who's a forestry consultant. He works in the UK, came from the forestry industry in the first place, and now works internationally around a whole range of things, including agroforestry. So, Andrew, maybe you could just give us a little bit of information about your background and what it is you do now.
So I work in a range of kind of forestry sectors, if you like. I lead a company called Innovaland, and we do large-scale forest landscape restoration projects. We're working in Ghana and in Chile and in Brazil. And what we're really interested in is how can we do large-scale forestry projects with communities at their heart that are delivering on, you know, multifunctional landscapes that are working around agroforestry, producing timber, and doing nature restoration as well. We sit in the middle as a catalyst and try and bring people together and make these projects happen. So in Ghana, yeah, we're working with, I think we've got over 1,000 farmers who are partnering with us now to do agroforestry, and that's growing cashew and mango alongside some natural forest restoration, which is being supported by AstraZeneca.
So is it largely corporate funding that's paying for that, or are you getting sort of...
Yeah.
It is. Interesting.
Yeah, it's multiple blended financing, I think is the technical term. So you've got farmers putting in their investment is their time and some of their land, and then we've got corporate finance putting the cash in and multiple partners. And we're working with local government there and central government that's got initiatives around, you know, agricultural development.
Thanks so much, Andy. Now, obviously, as I mentioned before, we cover a lot of forestry news on the website. And I have to say, you're very, very good at picking up on this stuff on social media. And it's often tips that I find from you that points me towards articles and press releases elsewhere. But there are a couple of stories that we put on the site last week. One is the UK facing a timber crisis? And then there was another headline, wood-based construction can reduce emissions and store carbon long term. So let's sort of start from that. Is the UK facing a timber crisis? And if it is, what is it? What does it look like?
The report that came out was looking at the longer term, 20, 30 years out of softwood timber availability. And I guess I don't think there's ever been a point in time when the UK hasn't been facing a timber shortage. We've been probably since people first came across the ice sheets, we've been facing a timber shortage and importing. We've always imported a lot of timber and fibre into the UK. And if you think back to the kind of post-war history of forestry in the UK, that there was that peak of planting in the 70s and 80s. And after the Lawson budget of 88, forestry was starting to tail off a little bit, then really tailed off. And in England and Wales, there's been very little significant new commercial planting since then. So what we're really seeing now is this bulge of timber of a 35, 40 year rotation. That's where we're kind of in the middle of that, or, you know, somewhere on that curve. And that will come to an end in 20 to 30 years time. And then after that, we've got a significant timber gap. And I think the report you're referring to talked about, I think it was about 50 million cubic meters downturn in softwood timber availability. UK at the moment is importing about 10 million cubic meters of sawn softwood and board, panel board, OSB, MDF, that type of thing. So we import about 10 million cubic meters a year. And depending on the strength of the construction market and the pound against the euro, that goes up and down a little bit. But 10 million is about fairly constant at the moment.
And of course, if other people are producing that timber elsewhere, then it goes into their own carbon credits rather than ours.
Yeah, and what the other thing that was on your website was an initiative from the European Commission about basically recognising the role of forest products in tackling climate change and sort of I can't remember the exact, but encouraging the use of forest, of timber and other forest products in construction. For example, the French government has got, I think came out a couple of years ago, all new public buildings must be at least 50% in timber. So this demand for more timber in construction, and I'm using timber as a bit of a shorthand as forest, I should be really saying forest products, because it's sawn timber, sort of bits of 2x4. And then also, as I say, mentioned before, OSB, MDF, panel board, and increasingly kind of cross-laminated, these big sectional beams, cross-laminated timber. So timber is a bit of a shorthand for a range of products.
Andy, could you tell us what are the main kind of consequences or issues with, I suppose, a fall in production or not increasing our own domestic production? Is it a lost kind of opportunity to do more locally, or is it more, are there bigger impacts than that in terms of increased costs, all sorts of things, or is it a mixture of different things?
It's a mixture of different things, and a mixture of different things in different parts of the country as well. You know, if you're a timber construction company or a timber investing in timber processing, that you're looking, you're going to go to the bank or your shareholders and say, well, this is the timber curve. We can see there's a lump here, and then it drops off. Most timber processing is a 20, 30-year investment. So it's difficult to get that longer-term investment. Yeah, so that's the main challenge of just seeing that coming, and everyone's known it's coming for a very long time. And it's less of a, if you see some of the original timber projections, it was a real lump. And that lump's been flattened out a lot. Public sector's done a very good job at trying to sort of normalize their production. Everyone's tried to spread this flat. As I say, it used to be called Ronnie's Bulge, after a gentleman called Ronnie Rose, who was a famous deer stalker in southwest Scotland. And the bulge has been flattened, but there's still quite a drop off coming. That's the challenge in terms of confidence for sort of longer term timber investment and timber processing in the UK, and then timber into construction and everything else, all the other bioeconomy we could be using.
In terms of what we do about it, so we've established there's an issue, and yeah, without, I suppose, a concerted effort to address it, it's not going to solve itself. So what would you say are the main things we need to do? Is it policy? Is it greater knowledge? Is it focus on different things in different areas? What would you say we need to do?
All of the above. I think part of the challenge is we've always had in the UK a very polarized sort of view of land use policy, whether that's kind of nature or food production or forestry. They've been in very separate silos. We need a much more holistic and integrated approach to those policies, which is an easy thing to do, to say, sat in a podcast and talking about integrated land use strategies. And it's just how that then is implemented and how that plays out on the ground.
Let me be slightly cheeky, Andrew. Let me just poke in a little bit here, because I just want to mention the consensus on food, farming and nature, because this was something after, there was a webinar that we did about 8 months or so ago that I chaired on behalf of Nature Friendly Farming Network and Soil Association, Food, Farming and Countryside Commission and the RSPB. And actually, it was when Phil and I first met. And you got in touch with me after that webinar saying, it is so frustrating that yet again we're talking about food and farming and nature, but forestry isn't there. And so you've got Phil; he's the head of policy. Go on, lobby him a little bit here.
Yeah, it needs to be part. We need to be at the table. Yeah, and there's a lot of we need to be at the table. Full stop. And we need to be thinking about when we're talking about land use. We need to be thinking about the role of land use in decarbonizing our economy and shifting to an integrated bioeconomy. And if forestry is not at the table, then you can't do that. And there frankly isn't enough limited knowledge and understanding of how the forestry sector works and the role of timber in that timber and the wider bioeconomy, and how we're going to have to shift to decarbonize.
Tell me, just when we spoke earlier on, you were giving me, don't give me any names of people, you know, these high level individuals, but there were a few confused messages getting through from people about what they think timber is actually used for. So what do people think timber's used for, and what's it actually used for when it's grown in the UK?
There's a fairly widespread perception that UK timber is mainly used for pulp and paper and biofuel. And if you look at the Andor at the moment, that all the sitka's being planted for carbon credits. So there, and if you, all this information is readily available. Forest Research publish really thorough statistics every year on where timber gets used, how it's the mills it's delivered into. there's only one paper mill in the whole of the UK now. It's at UPM Cali up at Irvine, and there's one paperboard mill, which is Igesund at Workington. That's it. There are no pulp mills in the UK. And this, but that perception of the UK timber is used for making toilet paper, I've heard several times, or making newsprint. I used to work for a company that made newsprint, and they don't anymore. So those challenges, if people don't understand why we're growing this stuff, then understandably people object to it. If people understand that 85% of houses in Scotland are timber frame and we're going to have to move towards that in England and Wales, then we need to be growing that stuff, and we can be growing that stuff in the UK.
Perfect. I'm going to come back in again. And on the consensus piece, yeah, I think there's definitely a need to kind of broaden the horizon in terms of the different stakeholders that we speak of. There is the intention and, I suppose, an acknowledgement of forestry as a sector, as an important sector. But I think, yeah, more could be done to kind of integrate forestry voices within that. So definitely heard there. I just wanted to ask, we've spoken about perceptions of forestry, what it's used for and what it looks like on the landscape. And I just want to know, where do you see forestry in 20, 30 years time? Because at the moment, I suppose everyone would kind of look at it, or a lot of people look at it in terms of large plantations that cover a large area of land. There's big economies of scale. Do you see opportunities for smaller scale forestry at a farm level, for example, kind of connected up over a landscape? And again, I think in that piece around the timber crisis, there was the focus or the acknowledgement that we can't really use broadleaves, or don't use broadleaves a lot in terms of forestry. Is there opportunities there, or is our climate just not suitable for that? And then I think that fits in with just the role of forestry in terms of communicating what it's for and what it does. And Finlow and I have touched on this before, so there's probably about three questions there, Andy, if you can respond.
Okay, I'll try and take them in order. On small-scale forestry, absolutely. And, you know, and there's lots of historic reasons why in the UK we haven't got that. We just got a huge gap. If you look in sort of the rest of Europe, there's a lot more smaller-scale forestry going on, and we could be doing a lot more small-scale forestry here and having a lot more farmers growing timber of all kinds on their farms as part, just another crop on their farm, which is fairly common in a lot of Europe. Part of that is just how forestry developed in the UK. We had a very limited forestry culture and woodland culture. There was some there. It reflects land ownership in the UK. And then we've got a sawmilling processing sector that reflects large-scale plantation development, if you like, the sawmilling we've got. Whereas in a lot of the rest of Europe, you've got a lot more small-scale woodland ownership. So you've got more small-scale land ownership, more small-scale woodland ownership, and then you've got a more varied sawmilling sector with that. It's that missing middle, if you like.
It strikes me that that's similar, actually, to the livestock sector, that you have a similar issue here where all of the livestock are supposed to be being channeled to ever larger abattoirs, where they're often having to travel, you know, substantial distances, hundreds of miles sometimes. And this is completely against the rise of agroecology, where livestock are needed, to help with re-establishing, with regenerating nature, but often they're being sold into independent supply chains, so you really need those smaller abattoirs. Is it a similar kind of challenge?
Broadly, I was just thinking the same, as you're encouraged to buy local agricultural products, and if you'd be hard pressed if you went to a local DIY store to, are they promoting, you know, grown in Britain have done a great job over the last 10 years. That again is exactly the same of having that smaller scale supply chain feeding local timber products, local agricultural products into local markets for local housing or local use. It tends to be large-scale processes, often at some distance, or you know, on the edge of a motorway network somewhere, and people have got no. You know, lots of people drive past Stevenscroft at Lockerbie on the M74. There's multiple companies there: James Jones, Forest Garden, the biomass processing. Again, that need for more smaller-scale forestry, more broadleaf woodland. There's great examples of broadleaf woodland being managed, but a lot. The vast majority probably not being managed, and difficult with the grey squirrels and deer numbers, but not impossible. There's a great event where I'm originally from in North Wales, near Abergele. Royal Forestry Society having a meeting there, small scale broadleaf woodland called Bronhall, I think it is, Bronhall, that's won all sorts of awards for small scale broadleaf management. So it's possible to do that, and you know, high biodiversity value, high nature value. But if forestry keeps being excluded, and it's being actively excluded, it's not a passive thing, it's an active thing. If you have things like the NFU tree strategy, which completely ignores timber production, it's impossible to have these integrated approaches to land use and land management. We urgently need it. Siloed thinking has got us into this nature and climate emergencies. It's not going to get us out. We need a much more holistic approach to these things.
Diversity is the byword, isn't it? It's the byword across the agricultural sector, and it also needs to be the byword in the forestry sector, that there is going to be a need for big commercial forestry plantations, but also there is a big opportunity for farmers and landowners to produce smaller scale, you know, 10 hectares or 20 hectares, if they're able to then process that and sell it locally into supply chains that make sense. And this kind of brings us, I guess, into that conversation around where Welsh farmers are at the moment, where there's this great big concern. I mean, it's by no means all farmers in Wales, but there is this great big concern about the idea of farms having to be turned over to 10% of woodland across Wales in order to be eligible for their farm payments. And of course, that's not 10% necessarily of new planting. It's bringing up what's already there in terms of coppices and hedges to 10%. But the conversation, as you mentioned there, you mentioned the NFU, a lot of the conversation is about woodland creation for habitat, as if it's a waste of land, rather than thinking about those commercial opportunities. Or actually, and perhaps Phil and I will talk about this later in the programme, the fact that having trees is very good for production of livestock and arable crops as well, because it helps to manage water and nutrients, etc.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And again, it is this integration, and how do we do that better? You know, how do we have these better conversations? Knowledge is a big thing. I've previously worked for Till Hill and Comfort, and I don't know how many years I've gone to the Royal Welsh, highlight of my year going down to Bilth for the Royal Welsh show, catch up with friends, you know, and lots of conversations around, well, what could I use forestry for? I've got some timber on my land. Is it worth anything? And we just don't have that. It's not integrated. I think I told you earlier, Finlay, that I went, after I left school, I went to Llysfasi to study agriculture, study sheep and beef. And about 6-7 years later, I kind of decided to go back and do forestry. And I didn't realize when I was studying agriculture that I could have studied forestry at Llysfasi. They were opposite ends of the, you know, it's a small college, opposite ends of the small college. But that, we don't integrate the two things very well. And that framing of tree planting as taking land out of production, when it could be, you could be growing timber, you could be doing some smarter kind of shelter belts, you know, smarter short rotation coppice, all sorts of things you could be doing. We tend to have this very siloed approach to, broadly for nature, conifer for production, farming over there. And it's, we've just got to get a lot smarter and have much more holistic approach to these things.
You mentioned at the beginning of the conversation your work in other countries around the world. Is that level of kind of siloization and kind of cognitive kind of dissonance between them all, is it similar in other places, or is there less of that?
I think there's a bit less of that. And again, sweeping generalizations, and it's easier. There's fables and things about people turning up from other countries going, oh, everything's, you know, everything's better
true,
over
true.
There. But no, I think patterns of land ownership are key. And then how forestry, you know, there's a joke that the UK had a forestry policy in 1916 commission, you know, and France has had one since 1619. My other favorite one is kind of Johnson and Boswell coming to Scotland. And, you know, something, there's a phrase like sort of Samuel Johnson saying, to see a tree in Scotland is as much a sight as to see a horse in Venice. This isn't new. You know, we haven't done forestry for hundreds of years. But no, I think in other countries, if you look at, you know, levels of woodland cover, tree cover, you know, in the rest of Europe, it's about 36%. You know, in the UK, it's 12%. In Scotland, 18%. But that, there's just more woodland and more forestry of all types. Mm. We completely deforested down to whatever it was, 3-4%. We then go, oh, hang on, we need to do plantation forestry. Oh, hang on, we've done a bit too much plantation forestry. We now need to do broadleaves. And we kind of, this pendulum swings in big, clumsy ways, and that's, and where we are now, maybe the pendulum's coming back a bit more, but we need to seeing all these different land uses coming together. And again, this comes down to a people thing as well. At the heart of this is, from a jobs point of view, we need multi-skilled jobs in rural areas. That, you know, where I grew up in North Wales, lots of people did farm work and they did forestry work. I didn't come from a farming background, but I ended up in farming after I left school, and then countryside rangering, and then ended up in forestry. So there's this kind of portfolio of skills is a good way forward. And then We need people doing policy that have got more of a portfolio as well, that come from a wider range of backgrounds.
And it's absolutely fascinating hearing what you've got to say. I mean, there were whole topics that I wanted to cover on this as well, but we've run out of time. Perhaps you can come on again, you know, maybe in a few weeks' time, and talk about these other things, particularly, you know, we've started talking about jobs there. It'd be really good to talk more about the rural economy and building jobs within the forestry and timber sectors. But also, I wanted to look at planning and how we can work with the forestry sector and how the forestry sector can help itself to get more new plantations and new forestry endeavours through the planning system, because I know that that's a challenge as well. But sadly, that is all we got time for. Could you just let people know how they can find you and how they can get in touch with you? I know that you're on Twitter at Andy Heald. Are you elsewhere as well?
I'm on LinkedIn, and Twitter is probably the best way to get hold of me, as you say, at Andy Heald.
Fantastic. Yeah. Thanks so much for your time. Really appreciate it. Let's go to a break. And we're back. And thanks again to Andrew Heald. Fantastic to hear that. And we'll try and get Andrew back in maybe 2 or 3 weeks' time, and we'll finish that conversation, particularly around forestry and the planning system, because it's a really important one, and better integration between farming and forestry going forward. Now, just for this last 10 minutes or so of the programme, we're going to talk, kind of wrap up, I guess, a little bit of policy around the UK. Quite a few stories coming out at the moment with the general election looming. The Lib Dems have promised £1 billion extra for English farmers, which would be very welcome, I'm sure. So we can talk about that maybe in just a moment. And then the Prime Minister was at the NFU conference offering more money for particularly technological approaches to agriculture and various other bits. But there were comments from the Soil Association and the Nature Friendly Farming Network that the PM actually just needs to map a realistic future for farmers. Phil, what did that mean? What was Martin Lyne's meaning when he said that?
From our perspective, it's setting out a long-term agenda and a long-term strategy and the different pieces along the way. And I think it's fair to say that what we've seen over the last 2 to 3 years especially are isolated announcements, of which there's a package of various different things that all look really, really good on paper, but they don't kind of create anything more than the sum of their parts. I think generally looking at what was announced by the Prime Minister at the NFU conference, a lot of it, as you say, was very much focused on innovation and productivity and technology on one hand, while you've got environmental land management and the payments attached to all the different actions that we spoke about before. And if there's not that kind of coherent link between the two, where you're looking at productivity and innovation that contributes towards more agroecological, nature-friendly land management, then you've got one element of the policy trying to do one thing, one element of it trying to do the other, and they're not joining together. I think the other thing that we're looking at as well is we've got these ambitious climate and nature targets that we have to meet. They're set in law. They're not just important from a legal perspective, but they're also really important in terms of improving the resilience of the sector, improving our resilience to climate change, enhancing that relationship between nature and farming to reduce reliance on inputs, for example, and improve profit margins. And we haven't really seen the evidence base that demonstrates that those are definitely going to be met. And one of the things that we've spoken about is evidence from the likes of CCC, which says the UK and the UK's agriculture sector is pretty unprepared from an adaptation point of view, which is really important within all this. So that's where we were coming from, is some welcome steps. But again, it's hard to see where you're going to in that ladder to the future if you're just taking steps as not part of a joined up picture.
And what about this £1 billion from the Lib Dems? You fancy a bit of that?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely. It's welcome to see a party acknowledge that the current budget is insufficient in delivering everything we want from agriculture. It's insufficient even in terms of delivering our environmental land management objectives and those alone. And we've got a whole range of other things that could be invested in to improve agriculture in terms of, yeah, as we say, productivity, in terms of supply chain investment, in terms of skills, knowledge, all those sorts of things. So it's very welcome to see. And it'll be interesting to see whether the Conservatives and Labour follow suit and make any sort of firm commitment to invest in agriculture. And one of the things I think is quite interesting in this space is that money is committed to environmental land management schemes and, yeah, is going to be invested in ELMs. It's worth having a look at the Liberal Democrats' food and farming paper, which sets out what they intend or what they would intend to achieve with farming policy if they were to come into government.
Now, moving to Wales, the Welsh Government says that it's listening. There are a lot of farmers shouting very loudly that they don't want to see this 10% requirement for woodland on farms. They don't want that additional 10% as habitat for nature. But at the same time, there are an awful lot of farmers who actually think that's quite a good idea. It's just that they're not shouting quite so loudly. So who do you think the Welsh Government's listening to?
Well, the test on that will be what changes they make to the scheme following the consultation. So we've seen from Welsh Government, they've been very clear that they want to wait till the consultation is closed, and those responses have been evaluated before making any decisions. There was a piece recently where Leslie Griffith has acknowledged that the scheme is likely to change, but that leaves Welsh Government in a difficult position in many respects, because they are going to have to increase woodland cover as one of their strategies in meeting their climate targets, for example. One of my reflections in this would be that there's a lot of anger against the scheme, but I think in many ways that is as a result of the situation that many farmers find themselves in at the moment, and the perception of the 10% and what it'll mean for their business, as opposed to the reality of that in many ways. We've spoken about it already, that the average level of coverage on most farms is 6-7% already. So to get to that 10%, it's not a massive increase. For some, it'll be very challenging, but it's on an average basis, it's not a huge increase. I think Andy made the point previously that it is quite a crude metric, and I think there probably is scope to look at other ways of trying to build woodland cover on farms that are a little bit more targeted and maybe a little bit more refined. But there's no getting away from it that, we are in a nature and climate emergency, and interventions such as these are going to have to be done to meet legal requirements, meet legal targets. But they're also going to be really crucial in terms of helping farming adapt to some of the challenges that are coming down the line as well. So it'll be interesting to see where we get to on that front.
We actually had a really nice piece that we had permission from Hugh Evans, who'd written it, to reproduce on the website, called Embrace the Canopy. And if people click on the article search, then they'll find that, where he's talking about the amount of agroforestry that they have, the number of trees that they've integrated with their livestock and various other agricultural elements. At the same time, you know, they have camping and glamping on site as well. But the amount of planting that they have there, they reckon they're sequestering around, I think it was 220% of the carbon that they're actually emitting through other farm activities. So they're, you know, remarkable. And from his perspective, everything is good. You know, having those trees there, it adds to the farm. It's not taking away from the productivity. It's helping, because it's improving the water management, it's improving the nutrient cycling, it's providing shade and shelter, it's making that land more productive rather than less productive. And a lot of the conversation that seems to be taking place, the high volume conversations on social media around Welsh policy, is that this is somehow taking land out of production rather than using trees and hedges cleverly to improve the productivity overall on your land.
Yeah, well, let's look at it this way. There's projections to show that sheep farming in certain parts of Wales will be unviable as a result of climate change under current warming scenarios. And that points to the need to create systems that are adaptable to that, to try and avoid that scenario coming to light. And trees and woodland have an absolutely crucial role to play in building that kind of resilience and that capacity to withstand some of those pressures coming down the line. So in many cases, it could be an investment to kind of safeguard your business And I think that is not getting acknowledged or looked at in as clear a focus as it could be.
And of course, as Andy Heald was saying, you know, there are commercial opportunities for woodland as well. It's not just about improving habitats for nature. It's not even just about trying to improve your productivity and manage your land more regeneratively and get those increased productivity elements out of that land. But there are commercial opportunities from the woodland as well. Anything else that we need to talk about today, just quickly, Phil?
The only other thing that I would flag for everyone is that we have a general debate on farming and taking place in the House of Commons today, so the day that we're recording, which is Monday. But I would encourage anyone who's interested to see what the general level of kind of political discourse in England is on food and farming, especially after the Prime Minister's announcements last week, to tune in to that retrospectively, or to take a look at the Hansard.
Fantastic. That's great. Well, I think that's all we've got time for today. I've been Finlow Castain. Bye for now.
And I've been Phil Carson. Goodbye.